This is the iMoveU podcast, getting you private practice ready. We give you fresh ideas on mindset, communication, and clinical skills so you can have a fulfilled career.
What a time to be alive. Welcome to another episode of the iMoveU podcast. It's Andrew here once again. And today I'm joined by another special guest. We have Brian Robertson from Optimus Health Group. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you very much for having me.
Can't wait to discuss all things sports physio, sports injuries, and ACL rehab with you, Brian. For the viewers out there or listeners out there, tell us a bit about your journey into physiotherapy so far and how you got to where you are right now.
Yeah, sure. So originally I was born in South Africa, so a significant sports passion. And then when I finished school, kind of just wanted to continue on in sports, and that was the reason why I got into physio. Went straight into physio, and at the end of the physio course, I was kind of burnt out and just decided, I'm taking 6 months off, which was a really interesting new grad perspective to have. So I actually moved to Mount Hotham and became a snowboard instructor.
Awesome.
Which is completely not what you should do with a physiotherapy undergraduate. But the doctors on the mountain, I was really interested in the docs and the medical center, and started doing some shadowing shifts in between snowboard instructing. And they thought, well, we need a physio on the mountain. Will you do some hours for us? And yeah, that's kind of how I got into sports physio, became the emergency department physiotherapist at Mount Hotham.
That's pretty cool. Didn't know that about yourself. What kind of things came in on the slopes?
Oh, I was really thrown in the deep end. Hey, that's where kind of a lot of the ACL interest started, because skiers tend to do and rupture a lot of ACLs. So I got very good at doing a Lockman's and anterior draw. But there was a lot of trauma. So significant traumas. Even we were the ones that would attend car crashes on the mountain.
Yeah, wow. And
so through that whole process, I really had to upskill my trauma skills. So on the mountain, normally there's two doctors and two nurses, and they do everything. So they'll treat the low back pain for the lifties, and then, yeah, they'll do kind of helicopter evacs and stabilizing a you know, snowboarder who's had a significant crash and has a cervical injury. So it was, yeah, very, very wide range of things, but definitely thrown in the deep end and learnt a lot in that kind of placement area.
Yeah, that would have been a very cool start to the career. Very unique, such a broad range of things that are coming in, and such, you know, varying ends of the scale, having traumatic car crashes and then traumatic skiing and snowboarding accidents. How long did you do that for?
That was a 2-year period. So I did it for 2 winter seasons.
Yeah.
And then what I did was I moved over to Canada and did a season over there instructing. But when I was at Mount Hotham, and this is just sometimes where luck falls into it, I started treating one of the Australian Winter Olympic Institute snowboarders, and he really liked what I did, and he liked kind of my style. I think it was just because I was young and a snowboard instructor and understood the technical terminology of what he needed to do. And yeah, he eventually spoke to Winter Olympic Institute, and when I was over, I was during the Vancouver 2010 Winter Olympics, I treated some of the skiers and snowboarders while I was over there in Canada as well. So it was kind of a very rapid throw into elite sport through a combination of luck and also maybe just not being so serious. And I think that was really important. You know, I was kind of burning the candle at both ends as a snowboard instructor, and there's a very good party scene on those mountains as well. And then, yeah, working as a professional during the day, it was a really good period where I learned a lot but had a lot of fun.
How did you feel? You said obviously when you finished studying, there was a bit of that burnout. And then, yeah, I guess what you fell into was not what you probably had planned for the start of your career. Did that, yeah, spark more interest in what you were doing? Was it just a nice different way of starting your career? Like, yeah, how did that couple of years impact you?
Yeah, it was really different. I feel like I was kind of blindsided a little bit when I got into physio with the cardio and the neuro aspects. And, you know, my idea of being a sports physio and being really passionate about that didn't include walking 85-year-old Nana down the hallway and helping her with her sputum clearance. That said, my neuro placement has been the most valuable placement out of all for any of my sports rehab and sports, especially in ACL rehab. And hopefully we'll get a little bit more into that neuromuscular training aspect. But yeah, that was the kind of the final straw was I was knackered. I was just burnt out. I really struggled to get through cardio and neuro at the time.
Yeah.
And yeah, I just figured, you know, I hadn't traveled. I'd just gone straight from high school. Had to work really hard in high school to get into physio. And then, yeah, 4 years of physio straight out. And I was just like, you know what? I'm just going to travel and have a bit of fun.
Awesome. Good stuff. And then once you've done that, you've done a few seasons now in the snow. Yeah, you started working in some elite sports back here. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, so those experiences are obviously the emergency and hands-on medic training and trauma experiences bode well. Tied me in good stead for coming back into rugby. And so it was a combination of when I came back to Melbourne working at Scotch College at the school level and then getting in through Melbourne Rebels in the elite sports community, going through the academies. So starting at kind of under 12s and then working my way up under 14s, under 16s, eventually touring to nationals, the rugby nationals, the schoolboys. And then in parallel with that, opening up Optimus Health Group and running Optimus Health Group, how I thought we, in particularly in Victoria, how we should improve the on-field coverage of impact and trauma sports. And so that kind of parallel run worked really well with me, gaining a lot of experience around multiple teams, right from kind of junior level through to the senior elites level.
Can you tell us more about that sports coverage? I know I'm always so impressed to talk to you about how many teams and schools that your clinic covers. You obviously told us about what got you into sports and that trauma experience, but yeah, now to be able to share that amongst your team and cover so many other teams. Yeah, tell us a bit more about that.
Yeah, so look, it was just in a business term, it was a gap in the market. From a physio perspective, there are a lot of athletes who are hurting themselves and not getting the correct care. And so in terms of traditional first aid, that's where we kind of stepped in and said, hey, you know, especially in school levels, there were first 15 rugby, big 100 kilo guys running into each other and, you know, having really bad injuries, dislocated hips, fractured tib, fibs, and it extends to soccer and AFL as well. Yeah. But they had the first aid on site where it was either, it was black and white, it was really binary. It was put ice on it or go to hospital. And there was no in between, there was no diagnosis, there was no advice, there was no evidence-based, you know, treatment protocols, there was no this is what you should do, go see this doctor or go see this sports physician, or yes, you do need an x-ray, no, you don't need an x-ray. And so it was kind of that middle ground where, yeah, just through that experience of initially working at Scotch and then at Melbourne Grammar, we found that it was across all schools and across all clubs as well. And so we just started putting offers into local community clubs to say, hey, this is what it costs to have a qualified physio on field. And we did it at basically cost price because we just saw that there was a significant need. It was a good growth phase of building the business. And then when the injuries happen, it's actually really good from a private practice perspective avenue to, you know, have consults and treatment. So yeah, all those parallels line up really well, and quite often the same players would be playing at a club level and going to a particular school that we're looking after. So what we found was there was a continuity of care where we'd see them at club training and be able to give them a little bit of advice, see them in clinic on, say, a Tuesday and go through a full session, and then see them at school on the Wednesday and then club training on the Thursday again. So effectively we were seeing these guys 4 or 5 times a week, which is very good for rehab and adherence to rehab. If you've got your physio there saying, hey, you've got this tonight, you've got this tonight. So yeah, that's kind of how that whole thing came about. And now we look after, I'd say it's close to 7,000 athletes every Saturday in non-COVID times.
of course. But that's crazy, 7,000 athletes. How many, across how many clubs and schools is that, Brian?
It's about 32 different clubs and schools. And if you consider there's multiple teams in a club, it's about 70 different teams that we look after.
Yeah, amazing. I think what you said there, in terms of how it's normally, so black and white, like, is it ice and sit on the bench, or is it, you might need to go to hospital, is something that I think we can all resonate if you've ever worked in sports. And I think that's almost even how it can be taught sometimes. Like, hey, either it's, yeah, can they get back on field? And if not, ice them up. Or, yeah, they're in such a bad way, send them to the hospital. And I really love that you're feeling that in between, right? Like, what's the plan? What do we need to go do? Because you also hear so many stories just in the clinic where you might not be working for a club, but someone comes in and go, yeah, I had this traumatic injury 5 years ago. And you kind of ask about the history and what they did at the time, who they saw at the time, and there was nothing.
Yeah.
I wasn't really told to see anyone. Oh, I did nothing about it. It was the end of the season, so I waited during the off season and I just came back the next year. You know, I've had this problem ever since. So I really love that you guys can provide that guidance and plan for these players and these athletes. And as you said, how handy is it to be across both, you know, potentially school and club level, where you can actually watch and monitor and help guide these players 3, 4, 5 times a week. That's something no one really gets as a physio. We hope that they're doing their exercises out at their club or at their school, but you never really know.
Yeah, we're really lucky. Very lucky.
Tell us a bit more about the clinic, Optimus Health. So, who do you have on board? What services do you guys provide at the moment?
Yeah, so Optimus is interesting. Optimus is kind of, it started out of not being able to operate in a private setting how I would have liked. And so in my previous job, all respect to them, it was a really good traditional private practice. However, I felt like there were lots of different things that could have been done better. There were lots of roadblocks. And so being young and dumb and naive, I said, all right, I'll just open my own practice and I'll do it how I want. So fast forward 8 years, and I'm glad we did. Optimus, now we're in the heart of Richmond, so we figured really central location for people who needed to travel, and it kind of gives us equal access to anyone in Melbourne to travel in to the centre, and proximity to a lot of the big schools and the big contracts that we've got. That's kind of how we chose the location. We have got 9 practitioners at the moment, so bang in the middle of COVID. mostly physio. We do have remedial massage. And then we've also got, in pre-COVID times, and this is slowly coming back, we've got 4 strength and conditioning coaches, all ASCA level 1 qualified minimum. And that's it. So in terms of personnel, we've got 1 new grad, and the rest are in between 5 and 10, maybe there's one that's 15 years qualified. Everyone works in sports. Everyone has a sports team. Everyone oversees multiple physio students who work for us. We are all mentors. That's one of the biggest things, is our clinic is a learning and development clinic.
Yeah.
We typically take students from Dublin City University and from Queen's University in Canada. So we'll have between 4 and 10 students a year on placement with us out on the sports fields, in clinic. And then about 12 months ago, we opened a new high performance center.
Yeah, that's so what I'm super excited for.
The clinics
are always great, but the dream in a sports physio world is to have that performance center as well. And you're lucky enough to have it not on site at the clinic, but just across the road, which isn't too bad.
Yeah. So it was a brilliant venue that came up, and the space is incredible. The transition between physio and strength and conditioning, it's a perfect location for that to happen. And we've learned lots in the last 12 months, but it's just absolutely brilliant. 250 square meters, big open spaces for running and sprinting and acceleration and deceleration. That's what we kind of have been missing in clinic. And hopefully we'll talk a bit more about it with the ACLs, and going into kind of neuromuscular training. But it's just a great tool for us to have, and to be able to, you know, objectively measure someone doing a maximum sprint or an acceleration with a sled push. You can't really do that in a traditional clinic setup. So,
yeah. And just reflecting on my time as a physio and working in sports, one of my first jobs was at a sports clinic in Adelaide. And yeah, to be honest, our gym wasn't anything crash hot at all. We were working with elite sports within South Australia, but you know, we had a rack, we had a bar, and we had maybe, you know, 20, 30 kilos of weight, which again, you can maybe do some early rehab stuff, but really that end stage rehab that we're all passionate about with sports and returning to sport, it's actually quite difficult in most clinic settings, isn't it?
Yeah, very. And we do, we've got a small gym on site in the clinic, which is important for, you know, tendon loading and hypertrophy and demonstrating exercises that someone might go away to their own gym to do. And I feel like that's an absolute minimum. I think the days of physio being 6 cubicles and a few machines is long gone, or should be long gone, because exercise rehab is such a huge important component for physio now.
Definitely. I remember once I graduated doing some interviews and getting shown around clinics, and again another kind of sportier clinic in Adelaide, and getting shown the gym, and it was essentially a small little space, probably no bigger than a bedroom. It wasn't much. It was about half size of a clinic room, and they just had 1 kilo, 2 kilo, 3 kilo dumbbells, a gym ball, and some TheraBands tied to a pole. This is our gym space, and I was like, it's kind of a bit of space. I wouldn't call it.
And look, that's how we started, right? That's the first four years of Optimus. We had a bedroom-sized rehab gym. But it's nice to progress, and it's nice to now have a big high-performance center.
Needs to progress. Well, now tell us, who are you working with at the moment, Brian, in the sports world?
So at the moment, personally, I'm looking after Bentley Greens in the NPL and soccer in Victoria. And being a mentor for a few different other areas, Scotch College Soccer at the moment, and then interchange with one of the other physios with Xavier College and their first 18 football. So that's who I'm personally looking after at the moment. I'm really missing sports. I can't wait to, you know, it was last night in Melbourne, it was freezing cold and raining, sideways rain, and it was, I think it was probably like 8 degrees. And those are the nights where typically you're standing sideline in a good big heavy jacket with a medic vest on or a physio vest on, and you're like, oh, this is a bit shit. But I would have given anything to have been out in those elements last night, just being pitch side. So I'm really looking forward to getting back with those teams.
Well, hopefully that'll open up very, very soon. So you're out working in the NPL at the moment. You mentioned already, you know, you're patching with ACL injuries. I'm sure when you came on, that was probably a big focus for working with the squads. And can you tell us a bit about maybe some work that you've done in the NPL, especially in football, soccer?
Yeah, definitely. So in terms of ACL injury prevention, I don't know where really to start. It's changed a lot and it's progressed a lot over the last, I would say, even 5 years. So when I first started in sports, trying to get an injury prevention program across to the coach was probably the biggest roadblock, is why should they give up 10, 15 minutes of their coaching time to do an injury prevention block? And then people like Adam Kolvener, who, when I was across in Europe a couple of years ago when he was in Austria, I met with him and asked just for some advice. I studied with him. The work that him, Kay Crossley, Brooke Patterson at La Trobe, the work that they've done in the last 5 years has been absolutely phenomenal. And so that kind of leads into what we're doing at the moment. So in NPL, the combination between the warm-up and in soccer, we're very lucky. There's a culture of pre-activation, very strength and conditioning biased terms, but very happy that there's this 12-minute block that we get for pre-activation to do before their warm-up. So that's what we do at Bentley. in terms of that, what it actually involves, it's a multi-component exercise-based program. Actually, Kay Crossley and team did a really good systematic review, I think it was last year, across 11,000 female football players. And that was really interesting to see that kind of come out at the same time where we were just tweaking these programs. But that just showed a reduction in overall injuries by 27%. And across N equals 11,000 plus, that's fantastic. That was about multi-component exercise-based programs, and then it showed a reduction in ACL injuries in females by 45%. So now, because of that, that systematic review, because we oversee so many different clubs and teams, I've got the experience of the different coaches who, A, don't give a shit, B, don't know how to implement it, and then C, the guys who are kind of interested. And all I do is print out that cover page of the systematic review and highlight the result. They don't need to look into the setups and the inclusion, exclusion criteria and all that stuff that we do as practitioners, but I basically just hand that to them. And even the ones who are completely hesitant, after I give that to them, I say to them, look at this. This reduces overall injuries by 27%. I said to them, if one of those injuries was your superstar, and then insert whatever, whoever it is here, specific to that team, I say to them, if we could make them not miss 3 games a year, would you do this for 10 minutes? And almost every single coach that I've presented that kind of style to in that systematic review in the last 12 months has said, all right, let's do it.
Yeah. It's such a powerful way to get people on board, isn't it?
Because
if you don't have the support of the coach, it's really hard to implement this stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Spot on. And at Bentley last year, we went through 5 different coaches, right?
Oh, wow.
And that was really interesting. So it was the stalwart of the club, Johnny A, had been there for more than 10 years, and he had got a gig at A-League, and so he left mid-year. Then the assistant took over. Results didn't go well. So he was moved on, and then his assistant took over, and that lasted a week. Then we didn't have a coach for a while. Then the technical director took over. But all of them, I made sure that they understood the importance of that multi-component exercise-based program. and they're all fine with it, you know.
Yeah, good. Have you, even if it's not yourself personally, but have you experienced time where the coach hasn't been supportive of something like this?
Yeah, definitely. And probably as a younger, more inexperienced physio, I just kind of went with it.
Yeah.
There's a really good article around from British Journal of Sports Med around communication reducing injury burden in elite soccer teams. And that article really gave me some good tips. I'll flick it through. Mm. But that was around using coaching language instead of using physio language. And things like that I've learned, instead of using it's a change of direction exercise, you really need to become specific with the sport terminology. So Jose Mourinho, for example, he would always use the term defensive organization. And defensive organization, effectively, from if you break it down to a physio perspective, it's when you transition from attack into defense, and that requires a significant change of direction. Mm. And so instead of saying injury prevention with change of direction, it's actually, hey, I've got a drill that I'd like to work on our defensive organization with. And in the early days, I didn't use that. I used physio terminology or strength and conditioning terminology. Mm. But now at Bentley, that communication to reduce injury burden is significantly coaching based. And so that would be my advice to anyone listening who's maybe struggling to get it through to a coach, is you need to learn about the coaching terminologies or the coaching drills and really break down the physical movements and utilize that coaching language. And that's what I didn't do early days.
I love that. I personally haven't even used that language, and I'm glad I haven't run into many barriers, but that is amazing tip in itself, is to, we talk about speaking the language of our clients, but yeah, if we're trying to get a coach or a support team on side for what we want, let's speak their language as well. That was a very good tip. And yeah, some of these articles that you're mentioning, we'll make sure that we have them ready to post alongside when we release this podcast. Yeah. So that's awesome. Obviously, at Bentley, everyone's on side, which is great. The actual injury risk reduction work that you're doing, has that changed over time? So yeah. You might have been doing 5 years ago, how does that look now?
Yeah, look, I feel like we've got a much better handle overall as a physio profession, where we're kind of bridging the gap into strength and conditioning. And neuromuscular training is the big aspect. And this is kind of where I've done most of my work in ACL rehab. It also transitions into ACL injury prevention. Mm. So we do a lot more neuromuscular training. And when I talk about neuromuscular training, I feel like it's a really broad umbrella term. What actually is it? And this is where kind of discussing rehab after surgery, this is what I feel is the most important part, kind of 5 months to 8 months after ACL, is it's actually training involuntary movement. So subconscious movement. Yeah, this is where I could speak about this for hours and hours on end, especially if you look at, you know, return to play criteria. Very little has got documented objective measures of involuntary movement and neuromuscular training.
Yeah. Do you communicate that to your athletes and coaches? Like, do you go much into depth around this, or is this the more I keep this to myself? I know what I'm doing, and we.
Yeah, this is the physics nerd Brian coming out. No, I definitely don't communicate this stuff. I do amongst the Optimus team, so we always educate each other around these areas. But the biggest thing for me is the coaches need to keep it simple, and they effectively need to know, is he ready or is he not. The athlete really needs to understand this, and usually I'll use a conscious control versus subconscious control as kind of the subconscious control theory, I call it.
And just quickly on that, Brian, how do you go about explaining that to the athlete? Like, and do you find that they do understand that? Do you find that some struggle? Yeah.
Yeah, different analogies. Yeah. So if I make them jog towards me and they're really focusing on the jogging, I'll then make them jog towards me and count out aloud in numbers, starting from 12 up in sevens, right? So they have to go 12, 19, 26, then it starts to get difficult, right?
Yeah.
And I explain the difference between the two. The first one is just jogging and they're focusing on the human movement component. The second one, there's an external environment focus that they're on, and that's on the numbers. That's a really good introductory way to do it. And I explained to them that's the difference between when you're counting out loud, you're not focusing on what your legs are doing. Your legs are just working involuntary. And you know, that's the subconscious control that you actually can train. And that's one analogy or one activity that I use to do it. The other one is blinking. So, Andrea, can you blink right now?
I can.
Yeah. So that's a voluntary control. But over the last 40 minutes, you've been blinking involuntary. And that's the difference. Another one that I kind of explained to them is that we want to train that the subconscious activation of your lower limbs. Like, that's the most important part.
Love that. Nice and simple, both of those, and people can relate really well. I even had a bit of a giggle. I knew exactly where you're going to go once you said, well, you've been blinking that whole time. So I think that would really resonate with athletes that go, yeah, cool, I get that. Yeah.
And then when I speak to the physios about it, and this might be really good for physio students who are potentially listening to this, your neuroplacement is one of the most important placements if you would like to progress really far down this sports physio rehab track. The difference and knowing the difference between the corticospinal tract and the spinal column being a major focus on voluntary movement versus the cerebrospinal extrapyramidal tracts working on subconscious control, that's what neuromuscular training should be in ACL rehab. And I don't think it's well documented in undergraduate because there's so much else to learn, all the basics. But that kind of, that decision-making, that landing technique, it comes into different biomechanics. It's all about how your body should be controlled through your lower limbs, through those cerebrospinal tracts.
Probably just reinforces how much learning you've got to keep doing after you leave uni. Because I know, looking back, I don't remember much, but the theory, the heavy theory, you know, I definitely didn't take that with me from uni. And it was, again, working in sporting environments where, okay, I need to look into this stuff again and revise. And what's the actual practical sense of this? Like, what am I doing that relates to this with an athlete? Because realistically, I know there's going to be students or even new grads listening and thinking, oh, that kind of stuff, surely, like, yep, I get it. We kind of need to know it, but, you know, how practical is it? Well, yeah. As you mentioned, like, it's very, very practical. We need to understand what's happening so we can understand how the body works and how can we either rehab or hopefully reduce the incidence of these injuries.
Yeah, definitely.
So let's talk a bit more about ACLs. I know you're really passionate about the rehab as well as trying to prevent them in the first place. Where did that passion start? And yeah, tell us about your journey with ACLs.
The skiers, obviously Mount Hotham and over at Silver Star Resort in Canada. But I don't know why. I think it's because I observed a surgery pretty early on with Mr. Adrian Trivett at Cabrini, and he was really welcoming. And when I went into the surgery to actually see what the reconstruction looked like, that kind of kickstarted a bit more of an interest in that orthopedic surgeons know a lot around this, obviously, but so much that they learn and read and in their articles and their journals has such a huge impact on the physiotherapy and the rehab. And so it just started with me observing lots more surgeries and then understanding the types of grafts and speaking to the equipment reps. All of that really embedded my passion of ACL. And I would estimate I've probably observed maybe a couple of hundred ACL surgeries now. I've seen a lot of different grafts. I've seen a lot of different stuff-ups that the surgeons won't tell you about. They fix it. What else? That. And then being able to rehab them and then having a successful return to sport, that really, you know, it's just a significant passion of mine. Especially, it's kind of that we need to do better. There's a lot of we don't know. And that middle phase, that 5 to 9 month mark, is kind of where I've done a lot more individual research and discussions. And the passion stems from us trying to improve the whole ACL landscape, really, ACL rehab landscape.
Again, I think really important for our own understanding is can we observe more surgeries? Can we speak to more surgeons? I know for myself, I was fortunate enough on placement during uni at a public hospital. They had a couple of, they're always doing surgeries, but I got invited one day and it was lucky enough that there were two ACLs that day. There was a hip replacement, there was a toe surgery, but getting to see those things really sparked my interest in observing more. And then I was fortunate enough in my first job to also have a gig in a private hospital as part of the role. And again, got to know the surgeons, got to sit in more ACLs and joint replacements. And the conversations are gold, the just observing and seeing how different surgeons go about it and then knowing how does that impact your rehab. It's priceless stuff. So for you to have sat in on a couple of hundred surgeries is massive. And I think I would encourage anyone out there who has never sat in a surgery to, one, reach out, start finding connections if you can. Because I also find a lot of surgeons really encourage it. Like they're more than happy to have you in. That I found there's a big difference. I don't know what you found, that some will want to do their surgery and then make the time for you afterwards. And other ones are like, oh, Andrew, come over, have a look at this. And they really kind of get you involved. Yeah. And discuss the whole time, which is really unique as well.
And it's really interesting the difference between, so in undergraduate, you learn about a Lockman's test, but once you go into a surgery and a patient who's under general anesthetic and you do a Lockman's on them, it is way different. It kind of, everything clicks, yeah. And understanding the true passive nature of the structures in the knee compared to an active patient who maybe has a bit of hamstring spasm or it's absolutely fantastic. Yeah.
I think a big one for joint replacements, that was massive to see, how far the joint could go. And then you see them, you know, a day later and it's not going anywhere. And just knowing that, again, that difference of what's actually in control here and the impact of the nervous system afterwards. Again, quite a valuable tip is get in on those surgeries if you can. If surgeons get to know you and trust you, you probably get a few more referrals too, which if that's the world you want to work in though, if you want to work with ACLs or any other sporting injuries, you know, how good if you've got a surgeon who wants to send them all your way because they trust you.
Yep, definitely agree.
So tell us more then, you're getting into more the rehab and, you know, doing your own research to find what you think is most appropriate. Tell us more about that and where you're at in your thinking and, you know, it's always evolving. There's obviously conservative and surgical managements now, and tell us more.
Yeah, look, it's really interesting. The performer environment interaction is not well documented. When I say the performer environment interaction, it's about that extrinsic force and intrinsic subconscious control of your muscles. It doesn't matter if you can do 20 very good high quality control single leg squats. If you can't control that kind of descent into knee flexion when your focus is elsewhere, i.e. evading a tackler or catching a footy or trying to mark an opponent, that quad strength is unusable. So it is still important to be able to develop an hypertrophy quads for conscious control. But at the end of the day, it's all about the involuntary movement and kind of going through those rubrospinal tract training programs. So this is where, you know, landing technique comes into it. Repetition does improve the neuromuscular system. You do need those base building blocks. So you need strength. You need to be able to apply that strength quickly to power. You need to do it in three different vector planes. And this is kind of where my nerdiness comes into it. The vector force rehab theory. What I see is a lot of rehab athletes focus very well on straight line and then change of direction.
Yeah.
But they've not strengthened or been able to apply power in a force absorption manner. So from up and down.
Yeah.
That's why a lot of landing or bump off landing causes ACL ruptures. So trying to reduce the risk of that. And then multi-directional and rotational vectors as well. So lots of kind of parkour movements involved in this neuromuscular training. There's no set, or there's not even a framework of these neuromuscular training exercises. If in all the research that you see, you'll see they'll use the terms, they went through a multi-component exercise-based program, or they went through neuromuscular training 3 times a week. Well, what actually is that neuromuscular training? Yeah. What is that multi-component exercise program? And that's kind of the area where I feel like a lot of physios who see ACL rehab clients, they don't have a framework to be able to go through and go, actually, this is the rotational neuromuscular training that I've got to do for landing. And then this is the rotational neuromuscular training I've got to do for force absorption in a vertical plane. And yeah, so that's what I've been working on lots. That's what I've been discussing and kind of shouting from the rooftops and really trying to get collaborators involved. That's what really that performer environment interaction is really important for me.
It's a really, again, really good point. I'm a big believer in the same principle that we're not training every single thing that can impact our athletes. And for a while, I didn't know how to describe it, or I didn't know what it was exactly. And it's as you described that rotational change of direction. It's very rarely do you jump up, get knocked directly on the side, and then stick a landing. Right? Like, yes, it's good to practice, and that should be part of your rehab. But I know. So many athletes, I work in female football as well. So many athletes are scared around twisting and actually pivoting or up in the air and get knocked and, spin around 180 degrees and land. And we've got one player at the moment coming back who can nail all their agility, but they go out and do a drill and they have to just run off at a certain angle, and that worries them, right? And that also could be some of the other psychological things, but I think that's also just practice and really training all directions, training all forms, as you said, up, down, shock absorption type stuff as well. It's like, and what you said with the research is the same. It's very much, multi-directional, but they're still very standard which directions they use. It's very interesting. Have you got any go-to tips for physios then, apart from that basis of thinking, which I think is really good, that helps a lot of people, but any drills or exercises that you would point towards to help with this kind of stuff?
First off, it would be to speak to a very good strength and conditioning coach, and not a personal trainer and not someone who calls themselves an S&C. Go find an ASCA level 2 qualified strength and conditioning coach, because a lot of these principles stem from strength and conditioning. And this is where there's kind of a big downfall in the progression of end-stage rehab, where a lot of these things should be being done by a strength and conditioning coach, not a physio. And so that's the first bit of advice, is go speak to them about it, because they really understand a lot of terminology and a lot of different techniques and biomechanics that physios aren't taught. So that's number one. Number two is the best drill that I really like is the ability to run up, jump onto a wall, propel yourself off the wall and rotate 360 degrees and land, and then take off and sprint. While doing the counting exercise out loud and not getting any numbers wrong, right? So really, that's kind of my gold standard assessment is multiple directions of force absorption and production, utilizing actual walls, utilizing rotational vectors, and then training that neuromuscular aspect of involuntary movement. So that's my best one, is see if you can go up to a concrete wall, run up to it on an angle, jump up onto it, propel yourself and do a rotation and then land. That's my epic. Number
one. That is epic. We might see an increase in concrete wall related injuries after this podcast gets released.
And I've never seen that in a textbook either. So
it's, no, probably not. There's your research question.
Called the iMove U spin or something.
nice. I think a lot of physios just shitting themselves thinking about that now. So let's talk about further down the journey then. Your thoughts with really the, or maybe not further down the journey, but other thoughts on return to sport and maybe what you do as some clearance testing with Bentley at the moment.
We utilize a whole bunch of different objective measures. You can't improve what you can't measure. So look, a real good base level is the work that Randall Cooper's done with that Melbourne ACL guide, Randall Cooper and McHughes. And that's great for a base level, right? Yep. We have force plates. So we've got force plates from Bell Performance and a force frame as well, which allows us to measure things that are very difficult to measure. Ground reaction forces, ground reaction times, and doing this during those different movements and finding asymmetries that, you know, someone might be able to single leg squat the same amount on both sides, but then you get them doing a single leg counter movement, drop down jump on force plates, and you can see a 40% discrepancy. And so measuring this neuromuscular training or this involuntary movement with force plates is absolutely fantastic. I would highly recommend any practice to look into it. Even something as simple as a counter movement jump, you can implement from day one. So that's a significant objective measure for us. And there's a lot of good work coming out of sports surgery clinic in Ireland, and Endarkin and team, where they're doing a lot around the biomechanics and the neuromuscular training and objective measures around what is good for reducing risk and what is a higher risk. And look, at the end of the day, returning to play with ACLs is about reducing risk, and if you can tick off as many risk reduction items as possible, including biopsychosocial measures, that's what we try and aim for. The communication with the client, you know, that's the most important thing. Explaining to them what risk factors are for ACL injuries, and just trying to tick off as many of those as possible.
Yeah, beautiful. I agree. You can technically tick off everything on your list, but if that communication, that trust, that confidence in that athlete's not there, then they're still going to struggle returning to sport. 100%. Well, Brian, thank you so much for your chat on all things sports physio, sports injuries and ACLs. I found it super interesting. I can't wait to share this with our community, share some of those articles you mentioned. I think they'll be some game changers for people aspiring to work in sports as well. Thank you so much for sharing.
My pleasure. Thanks very much for having me on, mate.
What a time to be alive.
This is the iMoveU podcast, getting you private practice ready. We give you fresh ideas on mindset, communication, and clinical skills so you can have a fulfilled career.